Welcome to our university seminar, New Media Teaching and Learning. We're continuing the series we've been at for over a year and a half now on the relationship between digital libraries, learning environments, and the open web. I believe we've got two sessions left in that theme still to go. But on behalf of the Center for New Media Teaching and Learning, I want to welcome those of you who are visiting us today. And I'm here to just do a quick introduction of our speakers for today, and then I'll do my best to moderate the discussion once they've had a chance to show you their work. First off, Courtney Bender, here to my left, who's an associate professor in the Department of Religion, as well as Department of Sociology here at Columbia, and author of numerous works, which she has asked me not to mention. Teacher of many courses, including Theory and Method and Study of Religion, Religious Worlds of New York, Religion in American Public Sphere, Sociology of Religion. I think you get the idea. So today's session is called Sacred Landscapes, Spatial Data, Student Collaboration, and New Investigations of Religious Life. It focuses on the emphasis of space and religious studies, and the work that Courtney has done with our center on an environment that's a map-based wiki that many people here played a part in, that's known as Sacred Gotham. So Sacred Landscapes, take it away, Courtney.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me here today. I have to confess that even though here I am, I'm something of a Luddite, and although people in my department think otherwise, so this kind of right, it's sort of all relative, right? But so you'll have to forgive me if I'm a little sketchy with this PowerPoint stuff, which is, you know, not really a part of our world in religion, but we're hoping to change that slowly or quickly. What I want to talk about today is Sacred Landscapes. This is actually, the title is sort of an amalgamation of first the project that has been going on, Sacred Gotham, and what we're hoping that it moves towards religious landscapes. And CCNMTL has really been essential. I mean, this is sort of an idea that I had, and it's just been marvelous to be able to work with CCNMTL to actually realize this. And so thanks particularly to Mark and to Josh, but to many others who are in the room who've helped participate in this. The religious studies historically has been a field that's been very focused on texts, theologies, philosophies, sort of very much of a philological discipline, although also, of course, has had very many really important and interesting sort of sociological and historical influences as well. But in the last, I'd say, maybe two decades, there's been a real turn in religious studies to think not just about religion as text, as creed, as theology, but actually as it's something that's lived. It's something that people do. It's something that, in fact, people do in many different contexts, and in fact that these social contexts have enormous influence on the ways that religious people actually articulate what their theologies are and the ways that they live them out in practice. So this turn in religious studies, first, I think, at least thinking from my field, which is mostly primarily North American religions, I took a turn first to thinking about religion as it is practiced. So this wasn't particularly focused on place in any particular way, but we had a lot of really fascinating studies on things like Christian dieting or prayer, the varieties of prayer as a practice, religion and politics, sort of broadly understood, so these kinds of things. But beyond that, in the last decade, there's been another turn in this to think about religion not just as practice, but practice in place. And place meaning an actual physical geographic locations. And this really has been an incredibly important sort of, if you think about it, just kind of has taken the lid off of religious studies. So we now have we're really beyond a place where, you know, the kind of old modernist story where religion was something that was private, it was something that people did sort of, you know, it was kind of a vestige of some ancient thing that really didn't have that much influence in the world anymore. And it's now we are really beginning to see in very powerful ways the ways that religion, whatever that is, intersects in so many ways in public life and in a variety of settings that we thought about as being really secular. So one of the things that we were hoping to do, or that I was hoping to do with studying religion in place and thinking about this with students is to teach students ways and to think about and give them tools to thinking about religion lived in particular places, and to not do this in some kind of abstract way, but really to kind of take them to the city where they live, where they're working, where they're studying, and to look very much at the ways that religious groups have influenced social life, and likewise the ways that the social life of the city has really altered under people's understandings of practice. Now, there are some simple, well-worn examples of these ways that, say, for example, theologies shape the way that people live in community. If you think about just the sort of comparison between stereotypical Protestant and Catholic and Jewish religious theologies and communities, Protestants don't really have a place-based understanding of congregation. So if you're a Protestant, we sort of say, particularly now in the United States, you go where the Spirit leads, you go where your community is, it's a chosen thing. So many people drive very far to work or take an hour subway to go, to church, or take an hour subway ride. And we see, in fact, and I don't have data, I have data, but I don't have a slide, we see that, in fact, there are a lot of churches, and the majority of churches, and of many Protestant churches in New York City, where the neighborhood and where the church is located and the people who actually go to those churches, it's sort of a spread. In comparison, we have Catholic parish models where historically, and even now continuing into the post-Vatican II era, the parish is the model. So wherever you live, that's where you go to church. So in fact, you know, if you decide to go somewhere else to church, to another parish, it's often frowned upon depending on who your bishop is and so on. So this is a very different model, right? This is people who understand their religion and the place where they live geographically as being differently connected, we might say more tightly connected. And this has had incredible influence in the history of New York City, where you have bishops telling their parishioners that who, in many cases, with immigrants' communities being very poor, saying, you know, you must, to show your commitment, buy a house in this parish, right? So this actually influenced all kinds of real estate communities and practices throughout the 20th century. Jewish communities traditionally, particularly within the Orthodox communities, there are prohibitions against driving or other kinds of movement past what you can walk in to attend synagogue. So what we see in New York, is, particularly historically, is hundreds of synagogues that are very small but very much connected to a community, a tight community of people living within a geographic space. And in fact, in the early part of the 20th century, there were over 1,000 synagogues in New York, in Manhattan. There are now about a quarter of those. The reason is not because Jews have moved out of the city, but rather because theological changes have allowed people to move in different ways. And in some cases, we have things like this. Within, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the concept of the Eruv, but this is a line that's drawn and, in fact, is a string that's connected around a part of Manhattan that expands the space which is in which Jews are allowed to travel and carry things on Shabbat. So we have here, this is a fascinating example. This is an actual line that's actually maintained by people and is checked regularly to make sure that it's intact. And you can go onto this website or others and see if this is actually an intact Eruv. And if it is, then you have more freedom of movement on Shabbat than you would otherwise. You know, this is a lovely example, and this is actually, there are many Eruvs in many American cities, but this is a lovely example of a way that a religious group is actually sort of making a sacred space and identifying that and making it real within this grid that seems very secular and what have you. So we have examples like this when thinking about and teaching religion to undergraduates to think about religion as not just something that happens in homes and in churches and in synagogues, but is actually sort of lived out within the space of the city in many different ways. There are, of course, other examples that sort of tell other stories, not just about how religious groups tell people where to live and how to kind of organize their lives, but also the ways that religious groups use the spaces that they live in to imagine or reimagine their theologies. One of the nicest examples of this is a book by Omar McRoberts, who studies storefront churches in Boston. And one of the questions for him in his study, he's a sociologist, is why these storefront churches seem to have so little interest in engaging their local communities. For example, why don't you see very many soup kitchens or other kind of outreach projects within some of these storefronts? And in listening to the sermons, he realized and heard over and over again that the ministers in many of these churches, and there are exceptions, used the story of the city and its crime and its sort of its fallenness as a contrast to the church, the inside, the interior space of the church, as God's space and as sinless and as a place of redemption. And so here we see very much a different kind of building of a theology where the kind of story of the street as being something that's fallen and the church, which is something that is not, actually creates a kind of boundary that then allows people to take place in a certain kind of story of redemption and of coming into God's home. And this, Omar McRoberts argued, translates also into the social practices of this these churches, where they then make decisions not to engage the city in particular ways because that would be polluting or other sort of negative things. So we see in all of these examples that really religious communities are theologically either at a kind of broad level or very local level dealing with the places in which they live. They are living their religion through the places in which they are, whether that's through imagination, whether that's through dealing with something as specific as, you know, drawing a line or real estate or what have you. So what this then allows, and thinking about religion in this way, allows three ways to help students think about religion more broadly. I want to talk very briefly about these three things, and then I'm going to turn it over to Josh. Mark, sorry. which one? First, it's really quite important to teach students that religions are not static entities, but are in fact dynamic, changing traditions, and that they are changing in dynamic ways within the structures in which they live, in which they take part, and that these dynamics go both ways. So we have, for many times, we think about the ways that secular institutions impinge on religion, but we also see in teaching this way, we can also think about the ways that religious groups have influenced social life. And one example that my students just love is this one. This is a map by Property Shark of religious institutions, houses of worship in Harlem. And there, many of you know probably that there's a law in New York City that says that you can't actually have a bar within 500 feet of a church or a church entrance. I think it's not. So anyway, these lines are, of course, a little bit more than 500 feet. But showing this to students, say, look, here, if you have a place that has a high density of churches and houses of worship, you're likely not to, even in the year of 2008, you're not likely to have that many bars. So, you know, why is it, you know, so this really, of course, like, impinges on their life directly, because, you know, there's nowhere to drink. But to think about this, that, you know, this is not something that churches are doing, you know, sort of directly saying, you know, we don't want bars around, but the ways that these structures, the structure of this law, which was put in place in the 19th century, continues to have effect on the ways of commerce in New York City. And in fact, this law has actually recently been trotted out quite a bit on the Lower East Side when there's been a lot of local opposition to the growing bar culture on the Lower East Side. So this is actually an actively employed and deployed law. Another thing that this focus on space allows us to think about is the ways that the fact that religions really don't stay in place. They really are always on the move. And if we think about the kind of trend towards interest in globalization and transnationalism and all these other buzzwords that we hear around campus, it allows us to think about the role of religion as an actor within transnational and globalizing trends. And one of the things that we know very clearly is that New York City in particular is a city of immigrants, but that not only that, but that religion and religious groups actually play an enormous role in the ways that immigrants both come to the United States and also the ways that they find a foothold with in relation to other kinds of social services and other kinds of community things. And, you know, the kind of pictures, the kind of vision that students can find when they sort of start to go out and look at the religious world in New York City in particular really brings this home. We can also use space to think about the transformation of particular, or these kinds of ideas to think about the transformation of neighborhoods and the ways that, and this is just a, well, here's a storefront mosque, for example, that we have new groups that are coming in, and how do they actually begin to find space? We see this kind of mix between commerce and religion that seems strange, but we can also trace this as sort of an ongoing process. But beyond this, we can also think about neighborhoods, religious organizations, or religious communities changing by looking at things like architecture. So these are two lovely examples. The one, the synagogue on your left, was originally a Baptist church. The Baptist congregation left Lower Manhattan in the 1850s, and a Jewish Orthodox group took it over and actually has been there since in this church building that's now a synagogue. And then on the right, you see the reverse. So the synagogue that was founded in the early part of the 20th century on the Grand Concourse in 1976, that congregation moved, and it was taken over by a Baptist group. So you see, you can see this if you take kids out in the streets. Actually, you can find many examples of this. But this sort of tells a sort of a historical story of change, of dynamism, of religions that are moving within the city, and also of new entries in the ways that they actually make their place, the role of religion in this. So we can really, and the third, did I have a third? I thought I did. Oh, yes, I did. The third thing that we can teach, and that I think is really important, is that, you know, with an example like this in particular, is that New York City's, or religion is not lived out actually in isolation from other religions. So the kind of way that we used to think about religion is sort of, or teach it anyway, is that religions are intact, they have certain kinds of traditions, they have clear boundaries. But when you get out in the streets, when you're thinking in terms of place, you actually see the communities actually are abutting each other, that they're learning from each other. There's a lot of cooperation, of course, a lot of conflict as well. But this kind of unsettles by bringing in the kind of location of religion. It unsettles allows students and professors too actually to ask new questions about where are the boundaries of particular kinds of religious groups, of traditions. The issue of American pluralism is one that of interaction and tolerance are things that a lot of students at Columbia in particular are concerned with, and so this provides. What we were thinking about is that this would provide a way also for students to find themselves in places where religious people were actually dealing with issues of interaction and to see what we might learn from settings like those. So what this whole move towards studying religion in place, the emphasis on dynamism, on transnationalisms, and on pluralism, were sort of things that I thought would be really great to bring into a class. And to do that, not just through sort of, you know, reading books, but also getting kids out there to look at actual communities and to talk to each other about what they were finding. So that's what led me to CCNMTL and to the rest, which is Mark's gonna and the rest is history.
So this was obviously a very exciting project to roll up to us. I'm recollecting the conversations, the first reactions, and our first thoughts when Courtney came to us with this emphasis and these ideas, and that was about a year and a half ago. So some of what I'm about to say about the technology is already outdated. This is a very fast-moving. The world of mapping and the world of collaborative writing and publishing is fast-moving, so this is history in some way. I wanted to kind of talk about the design research project a little bit and some of the thoughts that were going through our minds as we thought about helping Courtney bring this emphasis to her students. It's very exciting to us, not only because of the approach to the subject matter, but also to the participatory nature of Courtney's vision, how she was really thinking about how to engage students in building cases that were using materials that were abundant and about a city that is abundant, and in a significant way making choices about data that they were going to bring in and visualize and show and share and substantiate claims about the city. You'll see in the project, she invited students to go out and claim different denominations throughout the city. And so there was that level of choice and decision in the project. And also there was the very real decision about how much or what kind of data to use that students would have as they look to shape arguments in this kind of fresh approach to the field. So she listed some data that she felt would be of significance to students as they were measuring religious groups in the city and how they work. And these included data sets like census data, land use data, transportation lines, and she also thought that historic maps would be of importance. But she didn't want her students just to sift through spreadsheets or even look at kind of canned presentations. She wanted them to actually build visualizations and to share these visualizations with each other. So if a student working on a Presbyterian denomination in Upper Manhattan would be able to see what another student working on the same denomination in a different part of the city was doing. So she wanted that sort of that attention to each other's work, and she wanted them to make active choices about what kind of data to switch on, if you will, in order to substantiate claims and analysis about these. You stop me if I get anything wrong, but that was the emphasis we were hearing. So we looked around for tools that would help, and there are some tools out there. I'm just going to flip really quickly through these until I get to.
There you go.
There we go. There are some tools out there that kind of out of the box go a long ways towards helping students work with data and investigate religious groups with data. This is a program called Social Explorer. It's openly available on the web, and it allows you to go in and choose a time frame. This is looking at religious groups in 2000. And within that time frame, choose a subset. So this is the Muslim subset of that. And you can zoom in and look at specific neighborhoods and see how Muslims are dispersed at this particular time period. So that was pretty valuable in and of itself. But I pulled down this menu to show that there's sort of a top-down approach that somebody has kind of decided what the categories, what the mixture of data is going to be, or what the presentation of data is going to be. In other words, Courtney had told us transportation lines were very important, and land use was very important, and census data was important. And maybe there was a report that would depend on the interaction of, let's say, transportation lines and land use over a couple of stages of time. So you can take snapshots, flat snapshots with this tool, but it didn't really allow students that sort of active choice. It didn't allow them to put together the data in a way that was unique to their emphasis and shaped to the claims that they might want to make. It didn't allow them to layer those decisions in any case. I mean, you can take various snapshots of various different maps here, but we wanted an environment that would bring their choices together and allow them to share their work with others. This is another drawback to a tool like this, where if I'm a student, I can kind of set up a map and I can look at it, but how do I share it with Josh, who's also a student in the class? How do I incorporate it into an essay? How do I refer to it later on when I'm writing an essay? Where's the collaborative workspace that allows students to look at each other's work? So this is interactive in a certain way. It's sort of a limited definition of interactive. You can kind of pull down menus and choose specific views of things, but you can't really interact with the data in a deep way. You can't interact with your fellow students. We had plenty of practice by that time of building wikis, in other words, collectively editable websites where students could get in and write reports and categorize these reports and have them all published in one place and be able to reference each other's work. Depending on the wiki, sometimes the students were all working on one report together, or several, a group was working on a report together, or sometimes professors were using wikis just as a sort of a publishing space that everybody was feeding individually. But we had plenty of experience with these collaborative workspaces. So the question was, how do we get visualized data into these collaborative workspaces in a way that would create a sense of collective activity and purpose and momentum for the class, allow them to reference each other's work and still work with the data in individualized ways? Here at Columbia, as several of our guests well know, we've got a great wealth of data. The Electronic Data Service was an instrumental partner at this time in trying to help us figure out what data, what was in the libraries here that would answer Courtney's ideas about the significant data for this project, and how to get this data into a place where students could easily visualize it, manipulate it, and share their discoveries with others. And this can be a bewildering forest, especially for undergraduates, finding the right kind of data and then figuring out how to visualize it. Maybe 3 years ago we would have been looking at a GIS visualization tool like ArcGIS or something like this, but teaching students how to use a very complicated tool like this is labor intensive. And would have tested everybody's patience, I think.
Especially the
ones. And then there was, I just wanted, it's a pretty old historic map in New York, I just wanted to remind us of Courtney's desire to have students also work with digitized historic maps in one place, too. So these resources are around us in abundance, my conversation with Jeremiah and others was how to get these resources into a collaborative workspace that would allow students to work with them in a very simple way. And luckily, right around that time also, was the real kind of advent of Google Maps as a collective or collaborative mapping tool that was built for the general public and very simple to move around, work, enter pins, claim locations, and there was also a standardized format for getting data from data sets into environments like these, KMZ files, and so that's basically the background, and that's how we got to building what we built, and that's what Joshua was showing you.
So let's go ahead and just dive right in and get to it. Here is Sacred Gotham. What, as Mark alluded to, what the idea with the wiki is it's a central place that students or any group that goes into the wiki can collaborate on text, or have discussions about text, edit each other's text, just a place to and publish your own work. So. One of the first assignments that's already been talked about, the students were asked to go out and choose their location. One sec. Find a place that they wanted to, their place of study that had some religious significance in the city. So you can see here in the places category where all of the basically places these students chose are listed. Each one of these titles represents a different paper, you want to call it that, a different student did. It runs the gamut from, I mean, obviously there are mosques and temples, as well as, I think there was a, what's the
cloisters one that, and the Chapel of Mirrors. I don't see that. There's an art gallery in Chelsea that...
That's the one I was thinking.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Very unconventional space. But, I'll just interject. As Mark was saying, students were given choice in what to decide upon. They had to stay in Manhattan. But this was a wonderful opportunity to talk about what is a religious space slash community to begin with.
Chapel of Sacred Mirrors.
Yes, sorry. Yes, the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. There it is. Okay, go ahead.
So each student came in. First they went to their place and chose their location. Then they came to this site and basically created a page and posted their work. And at first it might have just been a very brief introduction, I choose this place, because they could continue to edit and build on to that work. So let's look at one. I'm not going to pronounce it. So it's a mosque here that the student could first come in, create this page, doesn't take a lot of web editing or knowledge or any knowledge really, other than to just create the page and put in some titles and put in some text and images. So you can see that this report deals with the location, some of the history of it. It has pictures, maps, and we'll show you how they found this map, as well as this historical map, as well as some different census data that's layered over the maps. So it's fairly extensive. Up at the top of each page, there is a discussion tab that other students could see. After reading the report, they could go in and make a comment, saying, I like this, I didn't like this, did you think about this? And allow the writer of the text to respond as well. It's just an ongoing conversation. This isn't extensive, but some of them actually did have quite a bit more conversation. We could show you that later. So it's automatically set up for this, which allows the students to post, other students to view, and to have a discussion about it. This is a closed site, so only students from that were in the class could come in and see the writing, and edit and work on this site. In order to help them find one another, so they weren't all just working in their insulated paper just typing away, we wanted them to be cross-referenced and locate each other. So down at the bottom here, let me go fast, we created a category section where they could say, okay, this is dealing with mosques, but it's also located in Harlem. This deals with civil rights. Also, so to assist an organization, they could say this was for this assignment one, whatever. So if down at the bottom, once they've put this in the mosques category, if you click on mosques, it goes to a page that has all of the papers that are in this category listed. So they could easily find one another, find another paper that dealt with mosques. This was on the Lower East Side, apparently. And they could find cross-referencing information and related research. At the same time, if they, rather than focusing on the religious similarity, they could say, well, I'd like to see what else is in Harlem, and I won't go into them, but you can see there are others in this category. So it allowed them to find one another and research what other people were doing. Now, this is one way to find each other, thematically or through text, but we also wanted to allow them to understand and get a visual idea of where all the research was being done. So we embedded this map in the page. And each one of these tags represents one of the papers that we saw in the places. Each of the students could come in and put a tag on this map and, put a reference to the research they were doing. So for example, here's the mosque that we just looked at. They created this tag, embedded the image, and put a link to the paper that they had done. So if we click on this link, you'll see we go to the paper that deals with this tag. So it really allowed students to see, find one another and see, understand, you know, even though, you know, we had the category of neighborhoods like Harlem, a lot of times that, you know, they might have missed someone who was two blocks away because they weren't in the exact same neighborhood, you know, they crossed over the line. But it, this really allowed them to look at where everyone else was. I know, for example, I think this is an example that the student who was doing the research on this Presbyterian church actually found this person, and there is some cross-referencing in the papers because they realized they were both doing research on Presbyterianism within a few blocks of each other. And so this allowed the students to find one another and see what other students were doing and see how those that research would intersect and how it would influence one another. So if we let's go back to the mosque here. Once they had their location chosen, they created their page, marked it on the map, and sort of created their place within the wiki. We wanted to give them tools that would allow them to do deeper research, find get a larger overview of the area they were looking at. So this image, for example, is a sort of a God's eye view, or Google eye view, same thing, of their research area. This one is a historical map, which, again, we'll show you in a second exactly the resources we gave them to find these things, but a historical map that allowed them to use as example of their historical claims or the research they made. As well as some census data. This one shows the racial diversity of the area and population.
This isn't an image that this student just found. This student built this image, yes. Created it, and we're going to show you how that happened.
So in the resources of Google, of this same site, we created, with the help of Jeremiah and his crew, some KMZ files that Mark talked about. Now, a KMZ file is a data file that can be opened up in mapping programs like Google Earth. So it is the document file. As Word opens up document files, Google Earth opens up KMZ files. And so we have them here to download. So if I'll show you how the process works. They would download other data. I have another one in there already, but they would basically save this file to their computer. And then when they open this file, it automatically opens in Google Earth. I'm going to turn some of these off, one sec. Sorry, this will go a little bit faster. Well, so when they come into Google Earth, they can come in and see their location, find their place of research, get the perspective they want. Zoom in a little bit more. And basically kind of visualize exactly the area they're looking for. Now the KMZ files that we loaded, when you load them up, they're opened up here on the side. So if you were to go download Google Earth on your computer, you would not see these files here on the left. These were brought in through the KMZ file. And what these do is they overlay this census data visually on the map. So the percentage of Hispanic in the year 2000, we see overlaid on the map. And now, what does dark blue mean? That's why we have the, we go back to the key. You have the key here. So they had to kind of use that separately to find exactly what the significance of the colors were. But you could also turn on this layers over other data. So we could also turn on the percent Asian, and then if we turn down the percent, so I'm turning down the opacity of the Hispanic and looking at what the Asian population is underneath, so you can kind of compare and contrast. So that would be census data. Some of the other data we have, cemeteries. One sec. Let me download another file that we can show you very quickly. If we do subways and roads.
Land use is actually sort of.
Okay, I'll do land use. We'll have them all.
Don't mean to, you know.
No, that's good.
Don't hold back.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So, in order to have students do this, did you organize the class so that, for example, Josh came in and taught people how to do this, or is it all self-explanatory?
Well, yeah, you know, one of our greatest concerns was that this was going to be a class about technology, which we did not want it to be. And so we really were careful. We had some, you know, grander plans than we actually implemented, but we kind of scaled back because we didn't want them to be spending the first half learning these tools. So the first class, I don't think I actually did any training. There was another class that used these same tools where I did offer a course that they could come to in the evening and we taught them. But Courtney will talk about, I mean, could talk about this better than I can, but I think students are, these are all tools students generally were comfortable with. There were a very small percentage that actually struggled and that we could focus on and help them. But, you know, most of the students have used Google Earth and Google Maps. KMZ files, I believe, were new to most of them, but it wasn't that difficult of a concept to grasp. Okay, there we go. So here's land use. You can see there's the vacant land, nothing in there. You can see residential.
You know, the metaphor of these KMZ files I always had was like a course pack or e-reserves, or, you know, a bundle of materials that the instructor had selected. You know, that would be the kind of center of focus.
But it's an interesting point about Cecilia Mattel's work, that you've got to keep that balance right so that it doesn't become a class about technology.
Definitely. And so here is an overlay of the land use. We can see residential with, need to turn up the opacity, sorry. Sorry about that. Here we go. So you can sort of see how they could work together to understand where the percent Hispanic is compared to the residential areas or where the non-residential areas. So once they've done this, you know, we also had historical maps to overlay to see exactly where the new areas of population were compared to older historical models. We also have old subway lines, a lot of information they could overlay on these maps, move around, and find maybe a snapshot or an area or a view that would sort of help document their research claim. It's then as simple as, if this were somehow supporting their claim, they would file, save, save image, and this basically this picture right here would be saved to their desktop as a picture that they could then upload to the wiki. Like an example, we see here. This was a file that he basically, or she turned on the correct layers in Google Earth, took this picture and uploaded it to the wiki, and here it is supporting her research claims. That's basically a quick tour of Sacred Gotham, and now that's what we set up for Courtney. Now I guess we're going to hear how it turned out.
Yeah, okay, so I will say that it turned out extremely well. The course, as you can see, had about 50 students in it. It was an introductory level class, so students actually were not required to have any background in religion or in sociology or history or anything coming into it. So that was a challenge, but also one that I think was sort of facilitated well by certain kinds of this kind of material. As Josh said, there were three projects that we asked the students to do to kind of go out and look. Then there was an historical project that involved some mapping, historical mapping, and an ethnographic and kind of contemporary project that involved going out and being somewhere, doing something with the congregation, for example, going to a service to write some field notes, and also doing some contemporary mapping like you see with this to see, you know, however the student thought that that would be important. And I mean, as you see from this, the students were incredibly creative and very excited about this in terms of going out and, you know, going to investigate something that. And I did ask people to, unless they had a reason to go out and explore a religious community that they didn't really know that much about, that wasn't their own home congregation or denomination. It was just lovely, actually. I mean, I think there were a lot of these projects that turned out extremely well. I'm just going to show you one. I have many. I actually have quite a handful that would be well worth sharing. But this one on St. Brigid's Church on the Lower East Side is just beautiful. This is actually a church that is no longer used for services, but has an active community of people who are trying to preserve it. And so there's the narrative of, you know, what it is to be Catholic and Irish in New York, and about the history of the conflict with the archdiocese and local groups, and what is the Lower East Side. This is right at Tompkins Square Park, so there, it involves all this kind of blue stocking stuff that happened. He uses all kinds of, he found a lot of maps in addition to the ones that we've provided, so there was a lot of kind of, and it's, as you can see, this is very well documented. This is his field work, and then like an astonishing. But you know, some of these students were just really. I mean, I'd say, you know, of the 50, there were about a dozen who were just so unbelievably captivated by this project that they actually followed me to a second semester where we used this wiki again to do more involved and in field work. So, so I'd say that it was. When it worked well, it did something in my classroom that I'd never actually seen before. Another thing that was really, in terms of just getting students to be quite involved in the they took a lot of care in the presentation of this as well, so it was something they really felt good about. And as Josh mentioned, the collaborative aspect of this was so key, and this isn't on the wiki, and I think in the future it will be, but the last project, we asked students to actually write a paper that was comparative. So they were actually writing comparisons, reading others' work, and involving in their analysis others' work from the class. And this, so we have just the example that I would give is we have this three mainline Protestant churches in Midtown. I don't know how many of you know St. Peter's, St. Bart's, and they're actually not all mainline Protestants, but two in particular, St. Peter's and St. Bart's were right here, and they're just around the corner from St. Patrick's Cathedral. And they've had such different, two of them are basically like falling down dead, and the other one's lively. And so the three of these women who were doing this project is confronting this, you know, how could this possibly be? You know, so how is this actually working? Great, great teaching opportunity. The shortcomings, and I will say that I'm actually more convinced about wikis and maps than I was even coming into this. But there were some sort of shortcomings and problems that we faced. One, which has already been suggested, that there was an enormous amount of material to cover in the course in addition to these projects. So we asked students to make an enormous investment. And, you know, in the end, I was most interested in making sure that they learned the material and did some projects and that they presented something beautiful on the wiki. So there were many projects that you could also look at in here that don't have the kind of flash, you know, beauty of the ones that Josh showed you. They were good projects, but they just didn't do the full thing. This wiki environment is one that you actually did have to learn some code to do. So this is not like the ones that are now available through CC and MTL. And some of the students did struggle with that, and I frankly did too. So I think it's actually a testament to how powerful this is that they were actually willing to learn it. And, you know, there are also these things that sort of, you know, horrible things that you hope never happen to you. A week before classes started, I went from 2.5 TAs to 1 TA for this course. So, you know, in terms of the amount the amount of people that I had who could sort of, you know, hold hands, it was a struggle through the semester. But I think that, you know, those are kinds of things that, you know, now in hindsight we can, help. I mean, certainly the change in this technology that's so much more user-friendly than it was even a year ago, and a half ago makes this much better. So what we're doing, and I mean, as I said, I'm really convinced by this and sort of what it's able to do and the kind of both the collaborative in terms of students who are actually doing the work and then the comparative possibilities for this, that I suggested sort of on a whim last spring that maybe we take this national. that's what we're supposedly trying to do now. It's going to be global now, but we're moving this, we're hoping to move this from Sacred Gotham, which is New York City based, to Sacred Landscapes and pull in collaborators in Nebraska and in Toronto who are religious studies scholars who are actually already invested in teaching about religion via place. So these maps, the Google Maps as sort of one connecting place. Josh, somebody else is going to show this stuff, but it's right, there you go. You can pull it out. But this allowed the kind of possibilities for understanding American religion. My last PowerPoint slide, which is now somewhere. You know, we tend to... where are we here? I want this one. Can I just get... Well, that won't pop up. No, that won't here. But, you know, we tend to... be a little bit like this in New York. And our students tend to be a little bit like this, too, with this New Yorker view of the world. So, or wherever we are, this is the view. So to sort of be more attentive to the, this is a classic cover, you know, but to be more attentive to comparison and to make sure that we're thinking not just that where we are is the defining place is very important, I think, for the future of this. So, we're already over 5 o'clock. Okay. So, I know Josh wants to talk about what we're.
Well, I mean, I think you covered it well. I mean, I think we'd like to see how scalable this is, and,
right?
And see if the model that Courtney has perfected is used in other areas and create a larger sort of environment.
Mm-hmm. But one thing I'd add about that is when you're thinking about this project running concurrently in Nebraska and New York and Toronto, the things that will allow students in these three participating places to really discover each other probably won't be the maps so much as the categories. And I think a lot of the success of this project, though it uses maps in interesting ways and it allows students to discover each other on maps and it allows them to build the map as an index of all the work, it's the categorizing and the work that Courtney did at the start to kind of conceptualize what the important categories would be, lay them out, and have her students kind of work along these paths so that they could find each other. So laying down the expectation that there would be a denomination category, that there would be a neighborhood category. Those very simple but very powerful sort of trajectories at the beginning of the class, I think, help them to discover each other as much as the maps. And probably when we take this project out to these vastly different areas, these distinct areas, until religious landscapes get so big that all across America or all across the globe there are these clusters of pins, I think that the categorizations are going to be the real point of interchange.
This also raises the really interesting questions. I know a lot of you said about before about student work and how interesting it is and how much you sort of wish that it could be accessible to other people. And then I know there are all sorts of rights and et cetera issues about that. But I mean, I find myself still living in New York wishing I could read all of this.
Well, this is actually part of our vision for religious landscapes, that in coordination with Courtney's colleagues at these other universities, that there would be a public-facing kind of journal, almost, that would be fed by the best student work that's done in these classes. There are rights issues that come involved. Mm-hmm.
So at this point, we should open it up for other questions or dialogue, comments. What do people have to say?
Maybe comment to the question you asked earlier, Patricia, about the technology used in the classroom, and I thought about the question, I do think that was something that we discussed a lot at the beginning when you first came in, about the kinds of tools to use, and part of what, whenever we have a project, just Courtney's project, is that we don't see some of the trajectories that some of these mapping projects that we've done in the past have taken. So our previous experience in a project that Ryan did with ArcView, for example, led us to say that if we went that route with something like ArcView, we would need to make considerable investments in student learning that tool before they can jump in. And so a lot of these projects have some of those elements behind the scenes and where there's those trade-offs in there. But even if I recall, some of the issues we had with Google Earth being on public computers was an issue. So we had to make certain requests for certain labs to make sure that they would run these tools if the students couldn't run them. So we spend, I think we always have to spend a little effort in understanding that when we're using tools that are very high-end, that in a course that's only 13 weeks, and you don't spend 6 weeks learning the tool and not really the content. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a constant in some of the discussions, but sometimes short-circuited by previous experiences that we've had.
John, mm-hmm.
First, just a quick follow-up to that. I mean, my recollections also include, first of all, that our GIS stuff could handle a lot of this, but part of this balancing technology and learning also has to do with a concentration on what makes the most sense for the students to grapple with. And if I remember correctly, I mean, we had conceptualized at one point trying to do everything inside of Google Earth. Mm-hmm. But aside from getting it onto the labs, Google Earth, I don't even know if it was at 1.0 yet. People's computers a year and a half to 2 years ago were probably too slow to actually have a comfortable experience in there. Mm-hmm. And we made this decision, a pragmatic decision, to have folks take screenshots and get them in and out of Google Earth as quickly as possible and into the wiki. And then we had this serendipitous, almost accidental discovery of how useful the wiki was for so many other activities in the class. In other words, at one point we hadn't completely flushed out or figured out exactly where all the help documentation and a lot of these other collaborative activities would reside. And it was partially through the course of that accident that we kind of got there, just as one thing I remember about this. But what I kind of wanted to ask Courtney, especially in terms of your introduction, I'm wondering about the dimensions that you described, especially including things like that A-roof, which mm-hmm. maps out a larger space, and I remember you talking about parade routes, mm-hmm. and also these dynamics that change over time. Mm-hmm. I mean, so what constraints have you begun to encounter using these tools which just let you, put a pinprick onto
right.
an XY?
We knew that the going in with the Google Maps and, I mean, to a certain degree, But Google Earth was very good because we had these overlays, which were phenomenal. I mean, I just think they were just so helpful. But, the inability of students to, in fact, map out a parade route, right, or to present that
I mean, they could have, one or two of them were very creative. They took a page, they like made a PowerPoint, kind of like they draw the little sticks in, and you know, but that was something we couldn't demand that they do, right? So, I mean, we were kind of, I remember we were hoping that there might be something within the frame of Google Maps or Google Earth, which at that time didn't exist, that could draw lines, literally draw lines.
And then over time, people also wanted to do stuff that progressed.
Yeah, I mean, there was, I mean, I think that they were able to, Social Explorer, which one of the things that Josh didn't show in Social Explorer is they actually provide these little, lovely little, I guess they're flash time progressions, you know, so you can actually see over time, the way that a community changes in terms of these demographic things. And, it would have been lovely to have a little movie in. I mean, one of the things that, so many of the students kind of were surprised to discover in the course is that, 100 years ago, there were, weren't that many African Americans in Harlem. Right, so who was there? Right, there were lots and lots of Jews in Harlem. So to think about the movement of African American churches to Harlem in relation to changing populations, and then what happens to these old synagogues and so on. To sort of put that more in a kind of dynamic, kind of filmic kind of way of story. They were sort of envisioning this in their head. You can kind of see the pictures that they had, but in terms of how they could represent that visually, I think there were some constraints. But, we had these, there were plenty of things for them to allow them to kind of tell a story, if not in quite the dynamic way that they imagined. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, kind of following up on Maurice's point about trying to make technology digestible and kind of get it out of the way for the content, mm-hmm. I think the same is true with library resources, that there's just this great wealth and... you don't want to get your students lost in all of the choices there, and Jeremiah's help in kind of filtering and streamlining that process for the purposes of this class is also an important way to get to the content of the course, mm-hmm. rather than get caught up in the process of finding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just wanted to show that the resources page here, which I started to fill in, and then several of the students became very excited about. They added things to the bibliography. They added one or two of these mapping resources were things that they added in. So, another lovely thing about this is that they were actually. The ones who were kind of turned loose actually were not just, kind of out there in the archives, but they were actually aiding their peers in bringing these kinds of resources back to the rest. So
yeah, we were actually worried about how difficult it was to put a tag on the map. They had to paste a little code and get a number, but right away, we weren't expecting it, but they were putting the links and the images up and everything much quicker than we thought. So. I think we were more concerned it would be a hurdle than it actually was.
This kind of project, I think, and I've seen it in other classes too, it opens up this kind of like big spread in the students. There's the power tech students who are really energized by this stuff, who will figure out how to get the picture under the pin, and then there are the ones who really, they're deeply engaged in the content, but they just don't have an aptitude for that. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a challenge, I imagine, as you're looking at assessing their work here, to not get dazzled by the mm-hmm. technical proficiency, or to figure out how to reward it, or how to make that a
right.
Benefit.
Right. I think that's. For me, that was the biggest learning process in the semester, actually. Or part of it. Especially for me and my TA working together and thinking about evaluation. But we did in the end, I think, tilted towards content in terms of, students who used the mapping things well actually had better content. So, it's not sort of content or form, but we had to think a lot about that.
Other questions or comments?
Has anyone else used this thing, perhaps in a different course?
Yes. This approach of having mapping within a wiki environment, we are using this again in different areas. I mean, a lot of us learned a lot from this project, I think.
It's actually much easier to do this technically than it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, so the wiki environment that Courtney alluded to, we're able to more easily drop Google Maps into it, not have students kind of bounce around from application to application. So these things are integrated more. And other faculty are finding this a very powerful way of presenting, you know, their field, place-based.
Okay, well, I guess we'll call it right there, but I want to give a little round of applause. Thank you to Courtney for coming by and talking about it tonight. And to Mark and Josh also for their excellent work. I failed to introduce them. Our next session is going to be on March 20th. We're going to have visitors from MIT. Mark, is it Visual Cultures? Is that the...
Yeah.
Excuse me, yes, the Visual Cultures Group from MIT who will be here. So hopefully you'll join us for that. And thanks very much for coming. Grab some refreshments on your way out.
Thanks.
So everybody will be free to come.
That's right. It actually worked great last year. We did the same thing. We booked during spring break. We got a great time.
Yes. Really?